Hello, everybody. Good afternoon or good evening. I'm starting on the dot because with a 4¾-hour opera and 25 minutes to tell you all about it, I have a problem on my hands. So I'm going to start right now. Welcome to this wonderful opera house, which our small city is able to have a major opera company. So we're all very proud of that, I think. And only major opera companies, by the way, can even think of doing Parsifal. So, and it wasn't even done here for the last 20 years. So you're privileged, and I'm going to say this at the beginning and again at the end. Don't think about leaving early. 4¾ hours is long, I know. But if you wait it, if you stick it out to the end, you will not be sorry. So there we go. All right, I'm going to get straight down to it now. First of all, a little chronology. Wagner was 44 in 1857 when he first thought about the possibility of Parsifal. He had read it earlier, but at that time, in 1857, he was right in the middle of writing The Ring, which, by the way, to me, is one of the major achievements of Western civilization, no less. I agree with you. He interrupted his writing of The Ring, having met a woman, and so he wrote Tristan. Of course, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful opera, too, which we had last year, and then Meistersinger. These both of which are 5 hours or so each, so they took a little while to write. Then he had to finish off The Ring. Two more huge operas, Siegfried and Götterdämmerung. So it took him a little while to get round, actually 20 years or more, to get round to finishing or getting started on Parsifal. He'd thought about it a lot. Once he'd started, it took another 6 years to write. Not surprising with this much music to write. So, by the way, interestingly, Tristan about love, Meistersinger about society, then his last opera, Parsifal, about religion, maybe. Keep that thought in mind. The theatre of his dreams had been built by now, Bayreuth, and this was to be, in some way, the culmination of that project. It had been underway for some time, but this was, in a way, what Wagner had in mind. It was so important to him that himself, even for the only short while that he lived after this, and then the family, prohibited performances of Parsifal anywhere except at Bayreuth. And indeed, it was not performed elsewhere legally until 1914, so a long time, about 40-odd years later. So there are a couple of reasons for that which are not important right now, but it's a long time to keep an opera exclusive. He had been already very interested in Arthurian legends. And you may remember Lohengrin. Just a few years back, Lohengrin, of course, is the Swan Knight. And as it happens, here's an interesting little snippet of trivia for you. Lohengrin is Parsifal's son. Curious, considering he makes an oath of chastity. He's a knight of the Holy Grail, and one of King Arthur's of knights, many of whom, by the way, were added later by medieval authors, in particular the Frenchman Chrétien de Troyes, and then, of course, Wolfram from Eschenbach, who wrote another version of Parsifal, the Germanic one, which is the one that Wagner actually based this opera on. Parsifal, by the way, in case you didn't get this, is Sir Percival. Right, so the story here is really one of the more complicated ones, and in spite of that, there are many of the familiar elements that you get in Arthurian legends and tales. There is a knightly quest. We do have a maiden of sorts, as we'll come to, in need of rescuing, again, sort of. And we certainly do have actually a mishmash of religious symbolism going on, as we'll get to. The central image of the Grail symbolizes Christ, of course, and indeed, it possibly even contains his blood. It is there, and it is intertwined with some of the Nordic mythological tales, and even Eastern religion, which had fascinated Wagner all through his life, creation of the ring and so on. Again, wait for it, I will give you some, I'll explain that a little bit more. However, it is incumbent upon me, one of my jobs in this position here is actually to give you an outline of the story. The program gives you the unabridged version with all the details. I cannot do that, otherwise I spend the whole time just telling you the story, and I've got more important things to talk about. But I do have to tell you the story. This is going to be a pretty brief version of the story. So, in case you didn't get the memo, by the way, Wagner, early on in the opera, mentions Sir Gawain. Any of you who ever did English Lit at college might remember Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Anyway, that's Gawain from the Arthurian legends, so we know where we are. The opera starts near Montsalvat, the home of the Holy Grail, which is clearly nowhere near Cornwall, which is where the Arthurian legends came from. We meet Gunamance, the faithful old knight, and then we meet Kundry, this is all in the first act, who has brought help, brought him healing balm. I'll tell you why in just a second. And then we hear about Klingsor, the wicked sorcerer, who is trying to destroy the knights for various reasons. Then we get the holy story of the Holy Grail. You remember, all of you Wagner buffs here, that Wagner would tell the story, and quite often more than once. So you often get the story and then a recap of the story in case after 2 hours you've forgotten what happened. So, the Grail is supposed to be the very vessel that Christ used in the Last Supper. That's the story anyway. And it may contain some of his blood, collected after his crucifixion. Anyway, here we are in the middle of a very Cornwall-type Germanic forest, and suddenly a swan falls to the ground. You will remember, of course, that Lohengrin was the swan knight. Enter Parsifal, who has shot the bird and understands nothing. However, Gunamance thinks he sees something in this young man that might bring healing to Amfortas. Amfortas is the king, and he suffers from a wound which will not heal. Until, that is, a poor, innocent fool, enlightened by compassion, can materialize. So, Gunamance crosses his fingers and wonders if maybe this young man might be the fellow. So, we hear the deep, so we then move into the hall of the Holy Grail, and very shortly we hear the deep sepulchral tones of Amfortas' father, Titurel, who had started this group. It really is more of a heretical sect than any sort of normal Christian group. But there we are, they are Christian, and they are interested in a sort of communion service, which again we're going to come to. So, they have this service, which is a little odd, but it does have a lot of the characteristics of a communion service. There's blood and there's wine. The wine is supposed to turn into blood, and the bread. We even get the mention of the bread. So it is really a kind of communion service. At the end of this wonderful scene, in the second scene of the first act, Gunamance looks at Parsifal and says, "So what do you make of that?" And Parsifal looks blank. "Don't know." So he understands absolutely nothing. So he is truly the holy, or about to be holy anyway, innocent fool. Not dissimilar, I hear you Wagnerians crying, to Siegfried, of course. So Act Two, we are now in Klingsor's domain, now full of alluring flower maidens. Klingsor is a magician and certainly a devil figure, no question about that. As you'll see when he arrives, he's very, very good with a wonderful voice and pretty scary, which he's supposed to be. He realizes that Parsifal may be the one to redeem Amfortas and the knights, so he orders Kundry, who we now see is actually under the power of Klingsor, to seduce Parsifal, because that's going to do the trick. If Parsifal, this holy innocent fool, succumbs to Kundry, all of his possible power goes away. So if you're a librettist and you have a tricky moment to negotiate, it's a very good idea to pop in a dream. That's what happens here. Although it's not very clear in this particular production, but Parsifal has a dream, and at the end of this dream, Kundry kisses him full on the lips. And as a result, he wakes up and suddenly realizes she has been trying to seduce him all this while, as have all of the flower maidens flitting around him. He is not impressed, and he manages to resist. When she kisses him, it's all over. He suddenly wakes up from this dream and is no longer the holy innocent fool. The first thing he says is, Amfortas. In other words, the man with the unhealing wound, it's my job to go and try and heal him. However, Klingsor is not very happy about this. He doesn't want this to happen. And so he gets his magic spear, remember that, magic spear, and hurls it at Parsifal. This is a very tricky thing to do in any production because you can't actually have spears being flung across stages. It's done quite cleverly here, as you'll see. this is the spear, by the way, the magic spear which pierced Jesus' side. That's how magic it is. Parsifal catches this spear. He does not let it get to him or kill him. At which moment then, of course, Klingsor's power is completely vanquished. Parsifal wins, Klingsor loses. And we are about to move on to the next act. And by the way, why didn't I mention that there's another character that we Wagnerians know quite well who has a magic spear? Votan. And that's the magic spear, the same magic spear. So here we go, yet again, Christian and Nordic stories getting mixed together and intermingled. Act Three. Many years have gone by, and Gunnar Mance, now a very old man, finds Kundry, and she is penitent and wishing for redemption. Remember that. This whole opera is about redemption one way or another. He wakes her, whereupon unknown knight appears holding a spear, sharp as a pin, as many of us old guys are. Gunnar Mance recognizes him as Parsifal, who has been wandering around for a long, long time trying to find Amfortas because he knows that this is the spear that can cure him. Kundry washes Parsifal's feet, very Christian symbolism there, and he is proclaimed king. By the way, not many Christian groups have kings, by the way, as their leaders. As his first act, he baptizes Kundry, very, very Christian again, and the newly perceptive Parsifal is amazed at the beauty of nature all around him and is told that this is the spell of Good Friday. Well, of course, that's the cue for the famous Good Friday music. Again, intermingling of symbolism, because this is all about nature at this moment, and you philosophy 101 students will remember that nature is often talked about and not necessarily intermingled with religion. So here we are, the last act, the last scene, I should say, in the Hall of the Grail again. The knights are yet again attempting to heal poor Amfortas when Parsifal appears. Titurel by this time has actually died, but Amfortas is still suffering painfully from this unhealing wound. Parsifal touches it with the magic spear and it is, of course, miraculously healed. Now the Grail can finally be fully uncovered, and Parsifal is acknowledged as their redeemer, the leader of the sect, and indeed king. So they all live happily ever after, except, of course, the wicked Klingsor, who has been permanently vanquished. Now, that's the story. I have left a little time here for some of the big questions. I'm not going to be able to answer them, but I hope I'm going to put some thoughts into your heads for you to think about in the next 4¾ hours. There have been a large number of books and articles, as we know, about Wagner and about his feelings about religion, particularly Christianity. I have already mentioned several rather unchristian Nordic legends. So how Christian is this work? Of course, we've got the central symbol of the Grail, the blood of Christ, and we hear the men singing of the bread, so there's a sort of communion service. And we have the washing of the feet and the baptizing of Kundry and so on, all Christian symbolism. But Wagner was very ambiguous about his own religious beliefs. He was influenced by a number of philosophers, as you may know, some of you, greatly by Schopenhauer, for instance, who was an atheist. And Wagner himself says at various times in his earlier writings that he is an atheist. But he was obviously a very thoughtful, deep, and spiritual man, and most certainly would have espoused many of the ethics and morals of many of religions. As we all know, most religions have some similarities in terms of what they believe. You know, not a good idea to kill people, don't steal, all the Ten Commandments and all that. Now, in Parsifal, he never actually mentions Christianity or Jesus, although we have all of these references to it. I don't have time to go into all of the leitmotifs. You may remember that a leitmotif in Wagner is a small musical phrase which depicts a person, a thing, a feeling, a place. It can be anything. And the one that comes the most in this opera is the famous Dresden Amen. There are leitmotifs for the Grail and for all sorts of other things going on. Not nearly as much, by the way, as in The Ring. The Ring music is made up from beginning to end of leitmotifs played in one way or another, as some of you know. So the Dresden Amen, I'm giving you a tiny example of you because you will hear it hundreds of times in the next 4½ hours. Here it's sung by Gurnemanz in the last act, and this recording is Kurt Moll, who was actually the definitive Gurnemanz of the last half of the 20th century. And he sang it here several times, including in this excerpt you're about to hear. It's called So war es uns verheißen. Example number one, please. Thus was it promised to us. So as Parsifal is crowned king and the leader in the third act. So the Amen is very, very appropriate, obviously, here. Now, here's a very telling quotation. I'm going to give you a few quotations which are things to think about. This was related by Cosima, his wife. Godhead is nature, the will which seeks salvation and, to quote Darwin, selects the strongest to bring this about. That's not a very Christian thought. It's not a bad one, but it's not a very Christian one. And it's a wonderful example, of the mishmash of thinking at that time, where science was changing the world even more, I think, than it is right now. Wagner described the opera himself in a letter to his wonderful patron, King Ludwig, the Mad Ludwig, as this most Christian of works. But first of all, I suspect that this was to please his very generous Catholic sponsor, the king. And it's also a rather disingenuous, if we had time to go into it, a disingenuous definition of Christianity. Here are a few more thoughts from serious thinkers on this very topic. Nietzsche, who early on had had a very deep mutual friendship with Wagner, explains it well. If Wagner takes up Germanic Christian myth one moment, seafaring legends another, that's Flying Dutchman, of course, then Buddhistic myths, then pagan German ones, then Protestant bourgeoisie, it is clear he stands free of the religious meaning of these myths and requires the same of his listeners. By the way, this relationship soured severely later on, as you might guess from this later comment by Nietzsche. If Parsifal is taken seriously, it would be seen as a curse on the senses and the spirit, a regression to sickly Christian and obscurantist ideals, and a self-abnegation. Not very friendly. So one of the themes of this great work is actually the renunciation of lust, even possibly sensual pleasure of any sort. But of course, that's a central part of many religions. And also redemption, as I said, as a theme. It's Kundry's redemption, and up to a point, of course, that of Amfortas too. Again, actually, a theme of many religions, especially, by the way, Buddhism. And actually, you may not know that Wagner toyed with the idea of writing an opera on the life of the Buddha, as indeed he worked for a while on a Jesus-themed work, which never came about. It could have been a cantata, whatever. And as I said, the Good Friday music here is actually a bit ambiguous. The American critic James Henker asks, "What is Parsifal but a version of the Black Mass?" The holy moments of the Grail itself, when it is brought out, turn out to be not so close to the conventional communion service that Christians know, but a little more sinister when you think carefully about the blood flowing, which earlier keeps Titurel alive and prevents poor old Amfortas' wound from healing and thus dying peacefully as he wishes. Rather than its traditional purpose of being transformed into wine, thus giving life and moral health to Christians receiving the sacrament. That would be a much more conventional communion service. This production even hints at Hinduism. There's a wonderful moment when the dancers, there's quite a lot of dancing going on, place themselves behind each other and have all the hands. So it's actually very much like a pictorial version of Shiva, Hindu goddess of destruction and transformation. The whole communion service in Act One is ambiguous. The blood from the Grail is transformed into bread and wine, actually, in a way closer to Dracula than the Christian church. And in any case, the purpose of this scene really is primarily to show that how Parsifal is the innocent fool who understands nothing. This is the first Act One. In my reading to prepare for this talk, I also came across this. Gunnemans reveals that he believes in reincarnation, saying that perhaps Kundry is doing penance for sins she committed in earlier lives. All of this seems really closer to Indian religions than to anything like mainstream Christianity. So this is an obvious segue to one last phrase to ponder. It comes at the end of Act One. Enlightenment through compassion. Again, really much more Buddhist than Christian. And it also struck me that for such a long time, there is no forgiveness for Amfortas, who suffers from this terrible wound, and for Kundry, who goes through her whole life suffering. That seems to me actually very unChristian, because forgive us our trespasses. Forgiveness is a central part of Christian religion. So I have mentioned that there are many books written about Wagner, huge numbers. Maybe at some point I actually said I think there are as many as there are written about Christ. This may not be true, but there are certainly huge numbers. So I'm going to leave it to you to pursue some of these thoughts. The program is very useful, by the way, and you may want to just think a little bit more about it. Whatever Wagner may or may not have believed, he did produce in this, his last masterpiece, a deeply spiritual and a deeply moving work, I think. Please, as I said, stick it out to the end. I've been here and people walk away after the first and second acts. Don't. I heartily recommend it. And whether you are in any way religious or not, I promise it cannot but leave you somewhat changed after experiencing it. Thank you.